From the Old City, a practical Torah commentary by Gutman Lodge. The Book of Numbers, Sefer Bamidbar. Numbers 19, Hukas. You shall not pass through. In this week's portion of the Torah, the children of Israel move forward from their encampment at Kadesh, thinking to take a shortcut through the land of Edom on their way to the land of Canaan. Moshe sent out emissaries to ask Edom for permission to pass through their land. Edom refused, saying, "You shall not pass through me, lest I come against you with the sword." The children of Israel tried again and explained to Edom that they would only go on the highway and not through their centers, and would even pay for the water they might drink. Edom repeated, "You shall not pass through." And then they went out against them with a massive thong and a strong hand. So Edom refused to permit Israel to pass through his border, and Israel turned away from near him. What do we learn from this? The children of Israel are all of us, literally and figuratively. The lessons we must learn from the Torah apply to us as a nation and as individuals. The individual lesson can be seen as this. Edom is the nation of Esau. Esau is Yaakov's twin brother. Whereas Yaakov represents the good inclination, Esau represents the evil inclination. Both are within us. We see here that we cannot pass through evil to come to good. Sometimes it seems that we can take a shortcut through shady practices to come to a greater good. The Torah warns that evil will come after us with a sword. We are not allowed to do evil, even if the end result would be good in our eyes. This principle is seen in Jewish law that tells us we cannot do a mitzvah through a sin. For instance, we are not allowed to build a sukkah from stolen lumber. If we did, it would not be a kosher sukkah. Although it might seem wise to steal from the rich to give to the poor, the Torah says no. When we come near something evil, it grows on us. Even when we promise not to go too deeply into Edom, and just to stay at the edge of it, don't do it. What seems to be a small sin today is not considered to be a sin at all tomorrow. And what is considered an unthinkable sin today becomes thinkable tomorrow. For example, the Torah warns a judge not to take a bribe, as it will blind him. But isn't he already blind if he is willing to take the bribe? The Torah is telling him that he will pervert justice if he takes the bribe, something he would not have considered doing had he not taken it. Remember, as usual, we can also learn the positive by reversing the negative. Passing through Israel will bring you to good. Just walking 4 steps in the Holy Land improves your spiritual outlook. Here, too, we are speaking of both the physical land of Israel and the spiritual practices of Israel. The good also grows on you, and what you called too much today, you will find reachable tomorrow. The lesson is, reach in the right direction. On a mountain. In this week's portion of the Torah, Hashem said that Aaron was to be gathered unto his people, that means to die, on Mount Hor. Why did he have to die on a mountain? In fact, why were so many spiritual highlights experienced on mountains? Here are just a few of the many times the Torah tells us that something happened on a mountain. Avram built an altar on a mountain. Avram was told to sacrifice Yitzchak on a mountain. By tradition, we learn that this particular mountain was to become the location of the Temple Mount. Tradition also tells us that Yaakov's famous dream of angels going up and down the ladder was on the mountain that was later to become the Temple Mount. Later, when Yaakov made a covenant with Lavan, it was on a mountain. Moshe's experience with the burning bush happened on a mountain. When God first enlisted Moshe, he told them, "For I will be with you, and you will serve God on this mountain." The Torah was given on that mountain, Mount Sinai. Moshe also died on a mountain. All of these wondrous things happened on mountains. But when the evil kings fought their battle, it was fought in the Valley of Siddim. and the valley had many pits filled with slime. What are we to learn from this? A mountain is a physical metaphor. Its very shape tells us what the Torah is teaching us here. The mountain is high. It is broad at its base and comes to a point at its top. From the top, you can see all around. From the bottom, your vision is limited. The higher the mountain, the grander and broader is the view. A valley is low. Your vision while in a valley is limited to the hills surrounding it. The deeper the valley, the narrower the vision. All of this relates not only to the physical perspective, but also to the spiritual perspective. When the Torah wants to indicate that something is high, it places that scene on a mountain. But what does it mean to be high? Is there a high and low in the spiritual world? There is no high and low in the spiritual world in a physical sense, but there is a higher and lower in the spiritual sense. The physical is the spiritual manifesting itself in a concrete manner. It does this from within the physical. In truth, the physical and spiritual are one entity seen from two perspectives. The external is the lower material perspective or world, and the inner is the spiritual or higher world. The terms higher and lower are being used just to explain this phenomena in a way that we can understand. But really, the physical and spiritual are in the same place at the same time. When the Torah wants us to think more spiritually, it tells us to go up on a mountain. The more spiritual, the higher the mountain. And when the Torah addresses a physical thing, it happens in a physically low place, like a valley. The lesson here is that when we wish to think spiritually, we must move up away from the broad base, that is the entirely multiple perspective, to the narrow, that is singular, top, and see that the many are actually a single one. And from there, we will be able to see all around. How is spiritual thinking actually accomplished? One exercise is to look at the place in front of you and try to understand its nature. What do you see there? If you say the furniture in the room, then you must look deeper and see that these are merely things that are in the place. If you say the walls and floor, they too are not the place itself, but merely things that are in the place. What about the concrete that makes up the walls? This is in the place where the walls stand. Whatever detail you can imagine in your investigation will just be another object that is in the place and not the place itself. This will be true until you begin to see that the place is not only where everything stands, but it also fills and surrounds everything. Know that in order to surround all, it has to be right here and it also has to be everywhere. This is thinking spiritually. Keep searching for the place that is both endless and right where you are standing. Soon you will see why one of God's names is Hamakom, the place. Then you will have moved your thinking from the broad base of multiplicity up to the singular peak, the spiritual one. Numbers 22:2, Balak, the power to curse. In this week's portion of the Torah, we read about Balaam, the prophet of the Gentile nations, who was attempting to curse Israel. Although Balaam was an immoral person, he had the mystical power to curse. Whomever he cursed would be cursed. The evil king of Moab, Balak, saw Israel advancing towards his land and was greatly frightened. He hired Balaam to curse the Jewish people in order to stop them from advancing toward him. Although the text tells us that Balaam also had the power to bless, and in fact did become a vehicle for blessings, the commentaries tell us that his power was limited only to curses. However, every time Balaam tried to curse Israel, God changed his words, and Balaam actually ended up blessing the very people he was hired to curse. If God had not interceded, Balaam would have been able to curse Israel. The logical question here is, how can such an immoral person have a mystical power? Aren't mystical powers gifts from God? If so, why would God reward such an evil person by not only giving him this power, but also allowing him to become the prophet for those nations? The Kabbalah explains that whatever man becomes attached to spiritually, that is what he will manifest. This is a startling statement. It means that no matter what spiritual practice someone engages, he is going to manifest something from his effort. Even spiritually impure practices can cause spiritual results. This principle shows that even if a person dedicates his spiritual practice to foolishness and nothing, still something could happen. We see this today with the many spiritual seekers of the world. Millions of Buddhists meditate many hours a day, literally on nothing. With such a foolish practice, one would assume nothing could possibly come from it. But no, the most successful of those Buddhists who meditate on nothing will gain a radiant glow on their faces, seemingly beyond nature. They will gain many benefits stemming from their great detachment from the physical world. For instance, they might look very young for their years. They might live long lives or appear extraordinarily calm, and so on. Hindus, whose spiritual practices involve outright idolatry, might very well produce some mystical power. There are gurus today who openly demonstrate these gifts. Also, there are Christian healers who apparently do open and amazing wonders. If indeed these are false religions, how can these practices produce such wonders? The Torah warns that even if a false prophet gives a sign or performs a wonder, we are not to listen to him. So we see that a false prophet can possibly do a wonder. When Abraham sent his children, whom he fathered with Keturah, away to the east, he gave them gifts. The commentators explain that these were unclean, evil powers. In the Torah portion, Ve'era, it is explained why Abraham gave them such gifts. So we see from the Torah itself that there are such powers in the world. Wouldn't it make more sense for God to reserve mystical powers only for the pure and righteous students of Kabbalah and not make them available through the crooked practices of the world? If God did such a thing, free will would be removed from the world. If all of the wonders came only from Torah practices, who would ever stray? But God wants there to be choice in this world. One of the basic principles is that God gives rewards according to the effort. If there would be no free will, there would be little effort. With these other powerful options, we have a real choice as to which way to go. If Balaam displayed no wonders, the nations of the world could claim that they behaved the way they did because they did not have a prophet to guide them. So we see that these false prophets do have powers. And sadly, many millions of their followers are satisfied with such wonders and continue in the practices that produce them. It is not just that they are satisfied with these wonders, but even worse, they believe the wonders are proof that their practices are right. Here we see the function of evil in the world. Without evil, we would have no real choice to do good. Free will versus the all-powerful. If these powers come to such people as Balaam, so that there will be free will in the world, then the question becomes this. Since God interceded and stopped Balaam from cursing the Jewish people, does man really have free will? When Hashem intercedes with the flow of nature, it is called a miracle. Other than these rare occasions, we are told that man has free will. But we're also told that God is omnipotent. This seems to be a contradiction. Omnipotent means all-powerful. If God is omnipotent, then by definition, he must have all the power in the entire creation. And if he has all the power, then how are we doing anything at all, let alone supernatural wonders? If he is omnipotent, who is choosing what to do, let alone doing it? This is called a paradox. A paradox is not a contradiction, as is usually thought. A paradox is an apparent contradiction. There's a vast difference here. Use the word all and the particular as an illustration. The all is all there is, or else it could not be all. Yet the particulars, the individual objects within the all, are also here. When you touch a particular, you must be also touching the all, because whatever you touch, it has to be the all. But still, you cannot say that the particular is the all, because this particular is not any other particular. It is just this one particular, whereas the all is the entire all, including all of the particulars. When man acts, he is acting as a particular, but really the all is doing everything. Since man is not conscious of his relationship to the all and sees himself solely as the particular individual, indeed he is choosing freely to do whatever he wants. The particular man is taking whatever steps he wishes, but still it is the all who is actually doing everything. How can this be? When we focus on the particular, we say that the particular is doing the act. When we focus on the universal, the all, we say that the all is doing everything, including the act that the particular man is doing. From the lower perspective, indeed, man has free will. From the higher perspective, we see that God is doing everything while allowing man to think that man is the doer. Here is another illustration to help explain this concept. Pick up an object with your thumb and forefinger. You clearly see that it is your thumb and forefinger that are holding up that object. Or is it your hand that is holding it up? Or is it your arm that is holding it up? Or is it your will willing that object to be held up? Or is it the you who is holding up that object? After all, it is you who are willing the will to make the body hold it up. Or is it the life that fills all who is holding up that object? All of these are true. Whichever perspective or area we focus on will be seen the one doing the action. The same is true with the omnipotent one who, in truth, is doing all, and individuals who see themselves to be the ones who are doing what they are doing. So do we have free will? Yes. Are we the ones doing whatever we do? Yes. Is God omnipotent? Yes. Therefore, is God doing everything? Yes. Is this a contradiction? No. Numbers 25:10, Pinchas, the holidays. This week's portion of the Torah briefly lists the yearly holiday schedule and the additional sacrifices that each holiday requires. During the year, as each holiday comes around, we read the section that lists that holiday's additional sacrifices. This means that sections within the portion Pinchas are read more than any other parts of the Torah. What is so unique about the holidays that they play such an important role in our lives? After all, we do not have the temple today, so none of these sacrifices are ever actually offered. We do not have the privilege of coming up to Yerushalayim 3 times a year to hold these feasts, so why are they still so important to us? Celebrating our holidays renews our history. Without the holidays, we would soon forget who we are as a people. And what is so important about remembering who we are as a people? If we forget who we are, then there would be no reason to carry on as a unique nation. And what is so important about being a unique nation? If we do not go on as a unique nation, there would be complete assimilation into marriage. This would spell the end of the Jewish people. This tragedy is evident in today's assimilated Jews. The more assimilated they are, the less they know about the holidays. Most assimilated Jews are not able to name more than 1 or 2 of the Torah's holidays, let alone know anything about their significance. And when there is no knowledge of their significance, there is no reason to maintain them. First to be forgotten is the last day of Sukkot, Shmini Atzeret, then Shavuos, the holiday when we celebrate the receiving of the Torah is forgotten. Next to go is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, then Rosh Hashanah, the New Year, the Day of Judgment goes. Next to go is Sukkot, when the dwelling in booths is forgotten, and last of all to go is Pesach. We can learn why the holidays are so important by seeing which ones go first and which are the last to be forgotten. Pesach requires the most preparation. It imposes the most requirements and restrictions. It seems logical that it should be discarded first. The holiday of Sukkah requires the building of the booth and the inconvenience of having to eat all of our meals in it. One would think that these holidays would be the first to be forgotten, but they are the last. Why is Pesach, with all of its details, the last to be forgotten? Because of all the holidays, it is the most family-oriented. Although all of the holidays somehow involve the family, Pesach is the most memorial. Sukkah is also memorial because the extended family comes together and enjoys a huge feast. And this is how the holidays hold us together. They maintain the Jewish family experience. But if Judaism requires the family experience, why is it that only the males participated in the temple service? Furthermore, only males lead the service and read from the Torah in the synagogues, and only males can be counted in a minyan, the quorum. If Jewishness is about the family, what role, if any, does this leave for the women? Are they to only be there for the family dinner? The Torah tells us that on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year, the high priest would first offer his personal sacrifice to atone for himself and then for his house. The sages explain that his house means his wife. In Hebrew, house and family are the same word, and as the sages point out, the wife is the family. If a man travels to a land where the religious customs are different than the place where he's coming from, and a question arises as to which customs he should follow, he is to follow the custom of where his home is located. And where is his home? Where his wife is. The center of Judaism is not the Temple Mount, nor is it the houses of learning. The center of Judaism is the home, and this is the wife. It is she who passes on the Jewish lineage, and it is she who instills her spiritual values in the children for years before they go off to school. While Judaism requires the males to be busy primarily with the services and learning, the wife has to busy herself primarily with the family. Obviously, this does not mean that the men are excused from the obligation of raising the family, nor does it mean that the women are excluded from the Torah. It means that each of us has to contribute what we are best at so that the Jewish family will thrive. It is a common scene to see the rabbi holding the baby in one arm and stirring the soup with the other while the mama is on the computer working out the details of the last real estate sale. It is a secular marriage that insists on equality. The Torah marriage insists on the merging of the two into one. 4 arms, 4 legs, 12 kids, everyone doing what they do best. Who's in charge here? In last week's portion of the Torah, Pinchas' action stopped the plague that Hashem sent because of the children of Israel's immorality with the daughters of Moab. Although many of the Jews were being rebellious by lusting after the Moabite women and worshiping their idols, one man's actions were particularly loathsome. He openly and brazenly brought his idolatrous lover to the entrance of the Mishkan, the tabernacle, where Moshe and the entire assembly were weeping. This week, that sinner is identified by name. Surprisingly, he was the leader of his tribe. What in the world was going on here? Could it be that the leader of an entire tribe in Israel could not find a proper Jewish woman to satisfy her desires? Was he so caught up in his lust that he had to have that very woman who made him worship an idol before she would agree to his cravings? There was a horse, a wagon, and a driver parked by the side of the road. The driver decided to go forward. He slapped the reins against the horse's back and called out, "Giddy up!" The horse lurched forward and started going down the road, pulling the wagon and a driver along with him. Although the horse is the power that moves everything, still the driver is in charge. He was in charge, that is, until they passed the pizza parlor. And it just so happened that this particular horse loved pizza. The horse snorted loudly. He turned sharply and ran right into that pizza parlor. What happened to the wagon and the driver? Well, they went with the horse into the pizza parlor. who was in charge then? Obviously the horse was. It was the horse who wanted the pizza, and it was the horse who ran into the pizza parlor, pulling the wagon and the driver with him. The horse is completely in charge unless the driver pulls back on the horse's reins at least as hard as the horse pulls forward. In this story, the horse is the animal instinct that we all have. This aspect of us is also called our animal soul or animal inclination. The wagon is our body, and the driver is our intellect, our intelligent or godly soul. Every decision we make in life is going to be made by one of these three faculties. The animal inclination in man is always hungry, if not for food, then for something else. It wants action, and it doesn't care too much what kind of action it is. The body is thoughtful. It wants to sit still, to veg out. If it had its way, the body would sit on the couch almost all day long. But the intelligent soul that we all have knows better. It knows that restraint and hard work are worth the effort. But if the intelligent soul becomes the least bit lazy, either the horse or the wagon is going to take charge. Can you imagine a leader of an entire tribe in Israel being so tied to his horse that he would take his non-Jewish object of lust right in front of all of the leaders of Israel? How great was his animal lust? How lazy was his intellect? Every step along the path of life is initiated by one of these three characters: the horse, the wagon, or the driver. Even today, a rabbi friend asked me if I had heard about the latest fad guru in India. "She seems great," he said. "She has over 30 million followers in a huge ashram in India." I said, "Yeah, and there's probably a lot of idolatry there too." "No," he answered, "she teaches universalism, and each group has its own area. There's a lot of love and charity, and each group has its own music too. It looks great." My first response was that today's teacher of Torah do not know how to give over the spiritual high that should be taught here, and if they did, no one would even think to go after such foolishness. I walked away thinking about this woman's trip and those 30 million people following her, especially all those Israelis there. I saw that the rabbi who told me about her in some strange way really admired what she was doing. He seemed to be looking at her trip with his usual good eye. He seemed to be thinking that maybe he could do something like that here, or even go there to see her for himself. How could I answer this learned rabbi? What is really wrong with it? If indeed she is not teaching Hinduism, which I bet she is, and if there are no other forms of idolatry or magic, which I bet there are, what's so wrong with what she's doing with these people? They are sharing love and giving charity, and there's great music too. I could see the great attraction this would have for young spiritual seekers, especially those that even know what they are looking for. How can I tell these good-hearted young people that being there, smoking dope, and doing whatever boys and girls feel like doing is not what they really want? How could I possibly convince them that what they are doing is wrong? I thought about this for some time. My first objections came quickly. Following that trip will surely lead to intermarriage and the removal of their families from the Jewish people. "So what?" they would say. "They're ready to give up on being Jewish anyway. Torah was never taught to them in such a way that being a Jew meant anything to them. So in their minds, what would they be losing? Surely being a Jew, as they have been, has mostly meant only trouble. Being Jewish like that is obviously not worth giving up all that kickback joy that they have found. Now they feel real freedom to do whatever they want and still can be called righteous and spiritual people. Why would anyone in their right mind start following all of those rules that the Torah insists upon instead of just being free like they seem to be?" Okay, if having a Jewish family does not convince them, then they have to know that the lifestyle that they are following will not give them a share in the world to come. "So what?" they would say. "This trip says they will have a share in the world to come, and your trip says they won't. Who are we to believe? Besides, I want the great reward now, not just a promise for later. And you know what? It's great here now. I'm here with my friends doing whatever I want to do. I'm getting stoned, having girlfriends, making music. Why do I need all that stuff you're trying to sell me? All those rules and restrictions that you're trying to lay on me? Then I remembered, okay, I understand that you have given up on being Jewish because you really do not understand what it means. And I understand that you have heard various things about the world to come, so you can ask, who shall you believe? But you know what? That trip over there that you are running to, we already did that. We did that to the nth degree. That's just what the 60s were all about. Kick back, sing songs, getting stoned, free love, to do whatever you want. We already tried the it's all okay thing, universalism par excellence. And you know what? We found out that it doesn't go anywhere. At best, it runs around in small circles, and after you run around those circles for a few weeks, months, or years, you still end up having to ask those same essential questions that you had to ask when you first started. What am I doing here? Why was I created? How have I made the world a better place? With whom do I want to make a family? We already learned that hanging out, getting stoned, and singing songs in a foreign language don't even begin to answer these questions. But why don't they? Over there they have highs from their drugs, love, and music. Why are those things not the answer to spiritual life? When someone smokes drugs, they experience what they call a high. Sometimes they even have an experience that they call a vision. So what is wrong with this? What is really happening to them is that the drug is lowering their threshold of spiritual recognition. It is not that they are being elevated spiritually like they think. A threshold is the level at which you begin to experience something. So if you have a high threshold for pain, you will not be bothered by a certain degree of pain that would bother someone with a lower threshold. When someone is drugged, depending upon the type of drug, his threshold of spiritual satisfaction is lowered tremendously. This means that he is experiencing the mundane physical awareness, but he is calling it spiritual. He is not actually experiencing the spiritual, but the drug is fooling him into thinking that he is having a spiritual experience. The obvious problem with this is that he is being satisfied with those lower experiences and will not feel the need to do the tremendous work that is really required in order to reveal the actual spiritual perspective. Why should he? All he has to do is smoke a joint and get high. The same thing is true about the love that he feels in those situations. It is not the deep love that comes from sharing life with someone. It is a superficial love based on feeling good in a time where other people are also feeling good. This does not create the bonding that comes from ongoing relationships. But my bottom line on this issue is not these things that I've told you here. My major thought on this subject is still what my initial reaction was. If only the rabbis knew how to teach the spiritual perspective in a palpable way, no one would ever even think to look elsewhere. Later, I checked out that woman guru's website, and as I thought, it is full of idolatry. For instance, she says such things as, today there are more than 300 million gods. Numbers 32, Matos. Watch what you say. This week's portion begins with Hashem commanding that whenever a man takes a vow or swears to restrict himself, he must follow through with the promise. The portion ends with the tribes of Reuven and Gad requesting to settle on the other side of the Jordan. They preferred that land rather than having a share with the rest of the tribes who were about to take possession of the land on this side of the Jordan. Moshe told them that they could settle on that land only on the condition that they would join their brothers, the rest of the tribes, in the battle for the land of Israel. They agreed and promised to do as Moshe said. So it is logical for the portion to begin with the strict laws commanding us to carry out what our promises are and to do whatever we say we will do. and to end with Moshe accepting Reuven and God's promise. Chassidus teaches that we not only must keep our expressed promises, but also warns us to watch very carefully every word we say. We are taught to say only good things to avoid creating any negative influences from our words. Not only are we warned about our words, but we are also told to think good. The saying goes, think good and it will be good. Do words and thoughts really have the power to change the physical world? Are words and thoughts real? Aren't they merely dissipating waves of energy? How can they affect anything? The soul is said to have a number of garments. These are thought, speech, and deed. Actually, the body is also a garment to the soul, but the body is a relatively fixed reality. Whereas thought, speech, and deeds are always changing completely, coming and going anew. The body is more or less the same from moment to moment. What we see about these three garments is that the soul not only vivifies them as it does the body, but the soul actually forms them. When the soul leaves the body at the end of its life, the body does not immediately disappear. It begins to slowly decompose. But when the soul leaves a thought, word, or deed, that thought, word, or deed immediately ceases to exist. Only the repercussions go on. This means that the soul is putting itself into these garments and is not only choosing how the garments are to function, but is actually forming and becoming that garment. By putting its spiritual essence into the world, whether it is as a thought, word, or deed, the soul is giving its life to creating that idea. The soul is a portion of God on high, and this spiritual reality is filling and forcing that garment into the world. So we begin to see why it is so important to think good. We see how our thoughts can go on to become our words and our deeds. What started out as being merely a thought may very well end up changing the physical world through its deed. But even if it remains a thought, still it is a reality. What can we do if we have a bad thought? Do we have control over what we think? Even our words are difficult to control. Even our grossest deeds are at times difficult to control. How can we rectify a bad thought, a bad word, or even worse, a bad deed? If these do go out into the world, how can we possibly call them back? The remedy for a bad thought is a good thought. Whenever you find yourself thinking bad thoughts, simply fill the mind with good thoughts. The mind doesn't care which it has. It just wants to be active. When you find yourself saying something bad, simply say something good. In fact, it is a good practice to say two good things for every bad thing you say. And when you find yourself doing something wrong, turn quickly and do something right. Just like we dress our bodies in the finest clothing we have, certainly we should dress our soul in the finest garments we have. Spiritual immersion. In this week's portion of the Torah, some of the laws regarding the spiritual cleansing of food utensils are given. One of the requirements to kosher a vessel is to dip it into a qualified gathering of water, a mikveh. The laws regarding the physical requirements and use of a mikveh are many. For instance, some immersions required specific intention, and if that intention would be lacking, then that immersion would not be sufficient. For example, when a Kohen prepared himself to eat sanctified food, he had to have in mind which type or level of sanctification that food was, and he would immerse with that in mind. However, in another case, if a Jew brought a pot that needed to be immersed in a river without any intention to kosher it, still, since it passed through a qualified body of water, it would become kosher to hold food. The requirement to immerse a food vessel applies only to a vessel that is owned by a Jew. A vessel that is clean but owned by a Gentile may be used to cook food for a Jew, even though it had not been immersed in the mikveh. This means that a Jew can borrow a clean vessel from a Gentile, cook his kosher food in it, and eat that food from that vessel. However, if the Jew bought that same pot from the Gentile and cooked that same food in it, the Jew would not be allowed to eat that food from that pot. He would have to transfer that food to a kosher vessel before eating it. We see that a Jewish food vessel, even though it is clean, cannot be kosher until it has been immersed. So the same food can be eaten or not from that pot depending upon who owns the vessel and not merely on the condition of the pot itself or the food's cleanliness. Why should a pot's ownership determine whether the food is permitted or not? This can be likened to a Jew who lent money to a Gentile for interest. Whereas a Jew is forbidden to charge interest to a fellow Jew, he is allowed to charge interest to a Gentile. Lending at interest is a perfectly legal arrangement. However, if that Gentile, who owed the Jew that money, would convert to Judaism and immerse in a mikveh, the interest due on that loan may not be collected. It is forbidden. Since it is the same pot and the same food before and after the ownership was transferred, and it was the same loan before and after the Gentile converted, we see that the requirement and result on immersion is entirely spiritual and not physical at all. How could dipping something into a pool of water possibly change its nature? What does a convert's immersion into a mikveh have to do with his receiving a Jewish soul? Why doesn't scrubbing in a shower permit a wife to her husband, but immersion in the mikveh does? Also, a child is born to a woman who did not immerse in the mikveh before its conception is called blemished. This child may very well have less favorable characteristics than the child who was conceived after the mother went to the mikveh. What is it about the mikveh that can reach into the next generation? Seemingly, it is just a physical pool of water. The spiritual workings of the mikveh are unknown to us, but its benefits are known. The benefits of a pure family life are so great that Jewish women have been known to travel hundreds of miles to reach a mikveh and only then allow their intimate marital life to resume. Jewish men have been sent into bitter exile in Siberia for many years when the oppressive communist government caught them digging mikvehs. But to the spiritual seeker, the strongest reason to take advantage of the mikveh every day is the Baal Shem Tov's testimony. He said that he attributed his great spiritual height to his frequent use of the mikveh. Numbers 33, Maaseh, the Oral Torah. This portion of the Torah lists each of the 42 encampments where the children of Israel camped on their journey from Egypt until they reached the Jordan River. Finally, after 40 years of wandering, they were about to cross into the promised homeland of the Jewish people. While certainly each of these encampments was a physical, historical encampment, still, we must know that these encampments are also 42 stages in our spiritual development. Each represents a different characteristic or stage that we go through on our own individual journey from slavery to physical freedom, and on to the spiritual freedom that is represented by our ascent into the Holy Land. How is it that only one of these encampments mentions the scenery? In fact, nowhere else in the Torah do we read what a place looked like unless the description had something to do with the location or was needed to understand the text. But regarding the camp of Elim, we are told that there were 12 springs of water and 70 date palms. The sages tell us that the streams represent the 12 tribes and the trees represent the 70 elders. But more interesting than the reason for the scenery being recorded here is clear proof that the written Torah points to a companion Torah, the oral Torah. In the text, there's absolutely no need, no use, nor explanation for these springs and trees. If this comes to tell us that the springs and trees are for drinking and eating, then what did they drink and eat at the other encampments? For this answer, we have to look to the oral tradition that has been handed down with the written scripture from Mount Sinai. Contaminated land. In this week's portion of the Torah, we are warned that when we go up into the land of Israel, the repercussions of sin will be much greater than they were before. For instance, a sin such as murder will contaminate the land in which you dwell. The laws regarding contaminations are quite complicated. For instance, we learn about what can become unclean and what cannot, what spreads the uncleanliness and what does not, what can be cleansed and what can not be cleansed. One area of the law that is clear, however, is that something connected to the ground, such as a plant or a house, does not become unclean from the most severe form of uncleanliness, which is the uncleanliness that comes from contact with a dead body. So the question has to be, if something connected to the ground cannot become unclean, how is it that here we are warned that the land itself can become unclean? The answer is, all of those laws regarding uncleanliness were referring to physical uncleanliness, and a warning regarding the land refers to spiritual uncleanliness. There are many spiritual aspects to the laws of physical uncleanliness. For instance, if the uncleanliness shows up on a bridegroom, we push off his isolation requirements until after 7 days of marriage celebrations. This does not make physical sense, in that the 7 days of celebrations bring many people in contact with him. If he is contaminated, there certainly is no physical reason to allow him to push off his isolation. Another example is when a house is about to be declared unclean. Although houses themselves cannot become unclean from contact with a dead body, they can become unclean due to a spiritual affliction. We are told that we can quickly bring all the vessels that are in the house outside so that when the house is declared unclean, those vessels will remain clean. Again, we see that this does not make physical sense and is allowed only because of the spiritual aspects of uncleanliness. However, with the uncleanliness concerning the contamination of the land of Israel, the Torah is referring to a type of contamination that is entirely spiritual. When there is sin in the land itself becomes spiritually unclean. This means that such things as seeing the spiritual perspective and learning Torah will become much more difficult than when the land was pure. In such a place, it will seem that God is hiding more. Good deeds will become rare, and kindness will all but disappear. When Cain, the first person born, murdered his brother, God said, "The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground." The sins of the generation are not just in the people who do them, but reach the land itself. One of the commandments incumbent upon all people of the world is to ensure that there are just courts in their land. If there are not just courts in your land, and if you cannot change this, then it would be wise to consider moving to a different land. We see that being righteous in an unrighteous place is not enough. Either we must change the place where we live, or the place where we live will change us.
ThereIsOne.com